Good morning, this is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Glad you could listen. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. About a year ago, Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast of Louisiana and Mississippi. In the devastation that followed, it became clear that our nation was not at all prepared to respond effectively to such a mega disaster event. Many people said many things about what Katrina revealed about American disaster preparedness, social justice, our economy and health system, among other things. The question is, what exactly did we learn? And a year later, are we taking the lessons to heart? During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk about the state of our preparedness for future mega disasters and the measures needed to become better prepared. Our guest is Dr. Erwin Redlener, director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. He's also president of the Children's Health Fund, which he co-founded with singer Paul Simon. Erwin Redlener is also author of the book we'll draw from during this hour, entitled Americans at Risk, Why We Are Not Prepared for Mega Disasters and What We Can Do Now, recently published by Knopf. The book pulls no punches about the state of our readiness for future catastrophes, whether they are natural disasters, or like a major earthquake or another Hurricane Katrina, or possibly another large-scale terrorist attack. In the book, Erwin Redlener also outlines a series of steps to become better prepared, and we'll talk about that during this hour. While we are on the subject of Katrina, I also want to mention another event happening in Champaign-Urbana this week that WILL is a co-sponsor of, Katrina After the Storm, Civic Engagement Through Arts, Humanities, and Technology, a three-day town hall meeting conference. It's also going to be on the internet too and online. It is an event happening at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications here in Champaign-Urbana. This free three-day summit will unite the experience and expertise of artists, writers, community members, technologists, scientists, humanists, teachers, healthcare professionals, and social entrepreneurs to inspire innovative approaches to social issues like Katrina revealed. And advanced technology will also connect the site to sites across the country, forming a virtual community. And if you want to find out more, I'll mention a website you should look at, www.katrinasummit.uiuc.edu. A bit more about our guest this morning. Erwin Redlener is a pediatrician. He's a medical doctor. And in addition, he's president and co-founder of the Children's Health Fund. He founded the National Children's Health Project Network, which consists of mobile-based and other primary care programs for severely disadvantaged child populations in 17 urban and rural communities across the country. And the fund's flagship program, the New York Children's Health Project, is the nation's largest dedicated health care program for homeless children. And Dr. Redlener joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Jack.
Thanks so much for your time.
Happy to be with you.
Before we talk about Katrina specifically, I wonder if you would say something about the response to September 11th in terms of disaster preparedness in the U.S. What have we done since then?
Well, as a nation, our progress in preparedness since 9/11 has been very sketchy and very much of what we'd refer to as a mixed report here. So that there are things that have gotten better, but a lot of what we thought we'd be doing has really kind of stagnated, and it's very difficult to tabulate what we've been doing on the preparedness side that's making us a whole lot safer than we were then, or at least more responsive. Among the things that are better, of course, is that there's significantly more awareness of the possibility of large-scale disasters affecting the United States than there was prior, and that awareness is slowly but surely increasing the sophistication and some of the planning. But by and large, what we saw on Katrina 4 years after 9/11 was pretty much the state of things, unfortunately, and that is that there's still a fair amount of disorganization. The planning process has been extremely flawed, and we are much more vulnerable than many of us would like to have thought or we should be at this point.
Let's talk about what happened in response to Hurricane Katrina. I know you have some criticism of the response at many levels, so here's a nice big softball question. How bad was it?
It was, well, in the let me just set a little stage here.
Sure.
Because I think it's fair to say that this was a very unusually enormous impact zone that the Hurricane Katrina affected. So As a point of comparison, I also did a fair amount of work after Hurricane Andrew in South Florida in 1992, which was a Category 5. Hit South Florida, very devastating, and affected about 300 square miles of landfall. Hurricane Katrina, in contrast to the 300 miles, affected 100,000 square miles of land in Louisiana and Mississippi primarily, but also a little in Texas and in Alabama. And so we were already starting off with something that was substantially larger. So one would expect that things would happen that we would not be able to perfectly handle. And by the way, with the flooding of New Orleans, we then had, on top of the vast land area affected, about 1.5 million people, at least temporarily displaced, some of them still displaced, which makes this the largest human migration in the United States since the Dust Bowl in the 1930s. So it's big.
Sure.
That said, what troubled people that looked at this and to try to understand what we need to learn from it was a tremendous amount of disorganization on the part of the federal actions, particularly, but also all levels of government did not function effectively. And we also realized that the plans that had been made beforehand to deal with, an evacuation were basically kept on the shelf. No one really referred to them, and even if they had referred to those plans, they would not have met the needs of the community at that particular time. So what we get a glimpse of is, first of all, a poor planning process. Second of all, is that the actual function of the federal government and its agencies to work with state and local officials did not happen. And third, that the bringing in of the military was late, and it also was disorganized, and we ended up with a series of problems that that really were very unsettling to a lot of people. And one of the things that prompted me to write Americans at Risk was the reemergence of the problem of radio communications among first responders. You know, that was called interoperability, basically radios compatible, which they were not, of course, on 9/11 between police and fire. Therefore, and a lot of people attribute that incompatibility with the fact that many firefighters died because they simply couldn't get word that the buildings were collapsing. When I went to New Orleans just a couple of days after Katrina, I found exactly the same story being repeated, not quite as lethally, but still we had first responder agencies unable to communicate with one another. This is now 4 years after 9/11. And I was thinking to myself, my God, how could this be? This is so fundamental, and we still haven't gotten a handle on this, and that's really what got me started in terms of putting things into this book. But the reality is that there were lessons, say, out of 9/11, but we just didn't learn anything from those.
The issue of interoperability applies not only to radios, but also, as you mentioned, the federal, state, local, the different elements of the responders. You know, it seems, you know, you've done a lot of work. You've testified, you know, in Congress, and you've consulted with a variety of government agencies. You know, and I guess I'm sort of still wondering, you know, there must have been a lot of thought about how these different layers will work together.
You mean before the events?
Sure.
Yeah, you know, there was the thought. There actually wasn't as much thought as one might think. There are bits and pieces of methods of people interacting with one another. For example, there's even law that that oversees, called the Stafford Act, oversees how and when the state governments need to call out to the federal government for help. And so there are some legal guidelines for all of that. But what really makes a difference is how, in practice, people develop the relationships before major disasters, say, between state officials and local military units, so that they, if something were to happen, that people know each other already, and they can move smoothly into the relationship during the time of an emergency that they really need to have. This is borne out. I had long conversations for the book with Colin Powell, because he and I worked together at Hurricane Andrew in Florida, and it was pretty flawless. It was very interesting to see how well that worked. And I was concerned that that same set of relationships did not, between military and civilian authorities, was really not working at all for quite a while in New Orleans. So, yeah, so the connectiveness that is, really, this is the basis, by the way, for people doing drills in local communities and the so-called tabletop exercises, mm-hmm. is so that people can practice what they've written on paper. They sit around in a room with a simulation of a major event, and they go through the steps that they might go through as the situation unfolds. And during those practice sessions, they learn who their counterparts are in other agencies, and that can be very helpful, but it did not work in New Orleans.
In the absence of that, in the case of Hurricane Katrina, there seemed to be so many, you know, graphic examples of the disconnect between the federal government and what was actually needed on the ground. You mentioned a few things, and it's probably worth, you know, sort of highlighting the resources thrown, you know, money spent that didn't end up actually helping people.
Well, this is the other thing that's so astounding, and you know, if you add up, and by the way, this is what I'm about to say, is very, very difficult to come up with, for example, how much money has actually been spent on preparedness and homeland security since 9/11, but it's well north of $200 billion. So where is that money? Well, some of it's not yet spent. It's been distributed, say, to the states, not spent. A lot of it, the majority of it, has been spent, but on things that are so random and disconnected that it's almost impossible to imagine. And part of the problem, Jack, is that no one has ever seen this amount of federal dollars being spent with so little accountability. So the Congress appropriates money, goes to the big federal agencies like Homeland Security and Health and Human Services, and then on to the states and local governments. But all along the way, there's less and less accountability for who's doing what with the money. So we end up in almost every state, for example, and this is such a unsettling thing to hear about, but you know, you have adjacent fire districts in the middle of your state or Pennsylvania or anywhere else, but where the fire chief in one district says, I'm going to use my Homeland Security money to buy, you know, hazmat suits for my firefighters. And the guy in the district right literally next door, contiguous with it, will say, we're going to use our Homeland Security money to paint the firehouse or buy a new fire engine or buy the police are buying, you know, bulletproof vests for their dogs. I mean, literally. So we have this hodgepodge of expenditures that when you put it all together does not translate into a cohesive planning process that says that we've spent this money wisely.
There's also been a lot of criticism of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which you write a bit about the problems that it encountered. And, of course, Michael Brown got a lot of personal, you know,
sure,
blame for all this. But you know, I think that the problem was beyond Michael Brown, that, you know, FEMA was,
sure,
taken into Homeland Security. And I wonder if you would, you know, sort of talk about that.
Well, here's the thing. This is this got really wrapped up into the you know, the politics of governing, so in the Clinton administration, there was a spectacularly effective Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, run by a consummate professional by the name of James LeWitt, who I personally had never met until I was researching the book, but I was well aware of him. That agency became one of the, you know, the crown jewels in the government. A range of agencies that are dealing with almost any subject, but FEMA was noted as one of the best federal agencies there was. So good, in fact, that there were many, many foreign visitors who would come and see how we did it so they could take lessons back to their own countries. When President Bush came into office, they basically did a couple of structural things that were very, very undermining of FEMA's abilities. First of all, it had been an independent agency with essentially cabinet-level status, so that James LeWitt was responsible to the President of the United States for the planning and management of, planning for and managing of disasters when they occurred. He was directly accountable to Clinton, for example. Now comes the development of this monstrous bureaucracy of Homeland Security, and FEMA now is absorbed, along with 21 other agencies, into Department of Homeland Security, reporting to Michael Chertoff, the secretary. And Chertoff, first it was to Ridge and then to Chertoff. Chertoff comes in with virtually no experience whatsoever in disaster planning or response. He appoints, or they appoint, Michael Brown, whose previous job was, you know, organizing horse shows. And so now you have the two at the top of the heap, neither of them having any experience that means anything. So a lot of the real senior professionals who had been around for a long time in FEMA just up and left. So you had bad leadership with a lot of mostly inexperienced, bad leadership at the top, an exodus of the real professionals from the agency. It left it weak, damaged, and undermined in terms of its authority and disempowered, really. So we got what you might expect, which was a complete fumbling of the ball by FEMA at Katrina. Now, they're trying to fix this, you know, and the new head of FEMA, David Paulison from Coast Guard, is a very, very talented guy with the right experience, but he's now having to rebuild an agency that was just mangled by these political decisions before. It's very funny, Jack. You know, every administration's got cronyism. You know, people get jobs for, you know, having helped out in the campaign or whatever. But usually those kind of appointments are made to, you know, you're become the assistant deputy in the Department of Commerce or the, you know, deputy ambassador to Liechtenstein. But this is unheard of. To take the agencies where we really need professionals and put cronies at the head of them has been very destructive.
We're talking this morning during this hour, Focus 580, with Erwin Redlener. He's director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness, easy for me to say, at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, and he's also president of the Children's Health Fund, which he co-founded with singer Paul Simon. We're talking about his book, Americans at Risk, Why We Are Not Prepared for Mega Disasters and What We Can Do Now. If you would like to join our conversation, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. I want to talk a bit about, you know, we want to broaden the conversation beyond Katrina because there are many other issues that we want to get to, but focusing for, you know, a little bit on that scenario, you write a lot about the healthcare facilities, and this is sort of a, you know, a good illustration of, you know, maybe the kind of scenarios we may see in the future if we don't pay better attention to those.
Well, you know, no matter what the cause of a major catastrophe is, it almost always, by definition, will affect the healthcare system because there's a lot of people going to be injured or sick, or so whether it's a bioterrorism attack or it's a pandemic flu, which are obviously connected to the healthcare system, or if it's a Hurricane Katrina that has so many victims involved, the healthcare system becomes a bottom line critical function that must be in place. And turns out that in the United States, the healthcare system and the public health system, both, in other words, on the hospital delivery, healthcare delivery side, as well as the public health infrastructure, these become, in a sense, the Achilles heel of all disaster preparedness. Because if the healthcare system can't function in a disaster, in a really large disaster, then everything else becomes secondary, because that's where people are going to need to go. So what we have now is a chronically weakened healthcare system because of two decades now of neglect and underfunding and, you know, trimming off all the fat, et cetera. And we're left with a barely functioning healthcare system, 46 million people not having access to the system because they don't have health insurance, all of which becomes an enormous burden during a disaster, and the inability of the hospitals to gear up their capacity when they really need when there was really reason to do so. That's called surge capacity, when the hospitals need to expand by some percentage what they could do every day so they can accommodate a major event. So the healthcare system right now is extremely weakened and unable, generally speaking, to respond to any large-scale disaster.
We'll talk more about that. We have a call to include in our conversation. Let's do that. This is someone in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question about the New Madrid Fault Zone. I realize
right.
That's a fairly big feature. And what is your assessment if that were to go tomorrow?
Yeah.
What would you see?
Very good question. You know, when you think earthquakes in the United States, most people say, well, you know, we're talking about the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is there are earthquake faults that run up even through New York, but a really big one is the New Madrid fault that starts down in Missouri and just runs north through Tennessee and up through the middle of the country. The problem here, of course, is that this is not something that's on the minds of emergency planners and certainly the public in the states that are most vulnerable to New Madrid. So we have very little in the way of earthquake readiness in those states, and that could be an unbelievable disaster if St. Louis or Memphis were to be at the epicenter of a major quake. I think we'd see an unbelievable amount of damage and loss of life, which is something that we're concerned about because there are things that can be done in terms of informing the public about disaster, earthquake and disaster readiness, and also the process of retrofitting buildings to be able to withstand earthquakes. And, you know, the interesting part here, too, is that we're dealing with a country that has literally 75 million Americans who live in what might be considered earthquake risk areas. So it's a lot of Americans who are at some degree of risk, and very few of them are living in communities that have done anything close to enough to be ready for that.
But basically, there hasn't been much done in terms of developing any kind of infrastructural response
Correct.
To that.
Correct.
And probably nothing will.
Well, these are, you know, we're talking about economic times, which are not exactly providing big surpluses any place in the country to do anything "quote unquote" extra. So that getting by day to day with basic governmental functions is basically, you know, that's it. It's, you know, it's using up the account. So this is something that really does require federal resources to help communities do what they have to do to prepare for major disasters, at least in my opinion. I mean, these disasters, you know, one of the tough things about the Katrina situation, for example, there was a tendency in Congress, yes, money was appropriated, but in terms of how it was appropriated, how much was appropriated, there was a tendency to say, well, that's their, you know, quote-unquote, their problem down in the South. I don't think mega disasters are really just regional issues. These are Americans affected. There's a large amount of real estate in the United States that was affected, as I said earlier, by the Katrina and the flooding. And I think there's a general population responsibility for helping each other in, to prepare for or respond to these large-scale disasters. So I wish there was more federal money, this is what I'm getting around to say, for earthquake planning and retrofitting in the middle of the country as well.
One of the things that happened in the wake of Katrina is there were a lot of people who moved elsewhere from the affected areas, a lot of evacuees, many, many, many thousands. And you know, again, turning to the healthcare issue to sort of illustrate the nature of how large the problem is. A lot of people, you know, they didn't have access to healthcare where they were, you know, where they found a place of refuge. And not only that, but there were no records about their, you know, health issues, heart conditions, diabetes, their medications, et cetera.
Well, Jack, I heard some stories that would just made me, I mean, I can barely tolerate it. But for example, a lot of children with cancer who are being treated in facilities, especially poor kids in New Orleans, those facilities gone, and the medical records gone, and the doctors left. They would wander, basically. So a bunch of them appeared at the St. Jude's Cancer Hospital in Memphis, where the doctors up there were, and I spoke to them, were scrambling to try to figure out where these children were on their cancer protocols, what medications were they on, what stage were they in. I mean, it was just a tragic situation having to do with, you know, very little redundancies in the system. So there were no central resources for the medical records to actually get those. And once they were lost, they were completely gone. And it was really turned out to be a horrible problem.
We're just about at our midpoint during this hour, Focus 580. Our guest, Erwin Redlener, he's author of the book Americans at Risk, Why We Are Not Prepared for Mega Disasters and What We Can Do Now. If you would like to join our conversation, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Avian flu is an issue that there's a lot of attention on right now, and it may or may not transpire into a pandemic.
Yes.
We certainly don't know. It has that potential. If it's not avian flu, it could be something else. But, you know, focusing on the healthcare system, I wonder if you would talk about, we sort of touched upon the issue of surge capacity, but, you know, what would be the scenario in the case of a real pandemic?
Sure.
And what would be the system's ability to respond?
Well, you know, first of all, the pandemic means it's really an epidemic that's occurring in everywhere simultaneously, hence the pan reference in that thing. And the problem with pandemics is that when they're severe, like in 1918 with the Spanish flu, they can be devastating to people, and large numbers of people get sick, and then large numbers of people don't survive it. So the cycle of pandemics, which occurs about three times a century, is something that we're paying attention to as we start seeing more and more of this H5N1 bird flu virus showing up in various parts of the world. So while it hasn't happened yet, we are worried that if it did happen, we could be in for some serious trouble and stress on all of us, including our healthcare system. And the general arithmetic goes like this. So we anticipate about 30% of people will get sick from a pandemic flu. So if there's 300 million people in the United States, we can expect something close to a million people, 100 million people who would get ill during the pandemic. Of those, maybe 2 or 3% would die, which means millions of Americans not surviving, and then some multiple of that, maybe 15 or 20 million people who will need to be hospitalized because they'll be sick enough to require hospitalization. Those numbers are enormous, but they also represent an immediate stress on the healthcare system, which simply cannot accommodate that number of people. We don't have enough hospital beds, medical personnel, mechanical breathing machines or ventilators, and we certainly don't have sufficient quantities of antiviral medication to treat people, and we haven't yet developed an effective vaccine. So all of this conspires to create what would be a horrendous catastrophe for the world and for the U.S. And so the question is, what is it that we're going to do about this? Well, there is a national pandemic flu plan that the president ordered and Health and Human Services produced. It's several hundred pages of guidelines and mandates, except there's not enough money available for the federal government to carry out those mandates. And this is where we are right now. We're funding programs to develop vaccines and to develop antiviral medications. We're not funding anywhere near where we should be the hospital's needs to be geared up to handle the number of patients that might come through. So we're just kind of in a holding pattern at the moment, hoping that this situation does not arise anytime soon, because we're just not ready for it.
One of the things that would help minimize the spread would be early detection. And there is, perhaps an issue there with regard to the ability of healthcare facilities to even do the tests. Is that...
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of barriers. I mean, first of all, we're in the process of improving the surveillance strategies. That means that our awareness has to be very, very rapid of a pending or impending pandemic flu. And there are laboratory ways to do that, and there's also just kind of keeping track of who's coming into emergency rooms to give us a hint that the number of visits for flu-like symptoms is increasing. That would be an early warning. But the other thing is that we want to also be able to very, very promptly identify and diagnose people with flu symptoms. And so the point we mentioned before is with 46 million uninsured people who don't have access, reasonable access to the healthcare system, these are people that are going to be waiting excessive amounts of time until they get really sick before they show up for medical care because they're not covered. And these people end up being, in a sense, like the typhoid Marys of the pandemic flu will be these people who are not insured, who are going around sick and spreading the disease. So here's a situation where we've had a chronic problem with poor access to the healthcare system in the United States for a couple of decades, and that's now going to turn around and become a really important barrier to getting this thing under control if we get a pandemic.
So you're arguing basically the equitable access to the healthcare system would be a good sort of preventive measure.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. This is, we would get a dual benefit here, and actually many of the things that we would want to do for pandemic preparedness would help bolster the healthcare system in general, so that, if you can imagine that if we could just solve the healthcare access problem, that would take care of one of the major stumbling blocks that would confront us if we were dealing with a pandemic.
We're talking this morning with Erwin Redlener. He's director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, author of the book Americans at Risk, Why We Are Not Prepared for Mega Disasters and What We Can Do Now, published by Knopf. If you would like to join our conversation, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. If you're outside the 217 area code, if you're listening online, et cetera, use the toll free line. We'll pay for the call. There's been a lot of congratulations, or at least, claiming some credit for not having another terrorist attack since 9/11.
Yeah.
And I suppose we should feel good about that. On the other hand, you know, it seems that there are a lot of liabilities, and you know, there are these things like, well, the recent incident in London,
sure,
which resulted in, you know, a restriction on liquids being carried on planes,
right?
And I just, you know, it seems like there's always going to be some other avenue or vector, and I wonder what you would say about, you know, in general, if are we pursuing a strategy in particular, or are we just responding, or what?
Well, a lot of people say, including the administration, look, we haven't had an attack in 5 years. Aren't we in better shape than we were? Well, the fact is that on some level we're in better shape because, you know, the government's gotten much better at identifying and disrupting the financial network supporting international terrorism. We've destroyed a lot of the Al-Qaeda headquarters, and certainly have killed in Afghanistan and elsewhere a number of the leadership of Al-Qaeda. On the other hand, as has just come out a couple of days ago in a new report by the government, is that the war in Iraq has actually been responsible for a vast increase in the dispersal of terrorist leaning extremists around the world, and it's become a great recruitment tool, so that the total number of terrorists out there has become much, much larger, so that the threat, according to this new report, is actually worse. This report is called the National Intelligence Estimate. It's considered the most authoritative analysis of what we know about terrorism and counterterrorism of all. And this report is prepared by something called the National Intelligence Council, and they are very, very concerned. It includes information from the CIA, the NSA, and all the major agencies. So the bottom line is that we should not at all in any way become complacent about this just simply because we haven't had an attack in 5 years. And people need to be reminded that it was an 8-year span between the first bombing attempts, first bombings actually, on the World Trade Center in 1993, and then the massive attack in 2001. Secondly, there isn't really any area of our safety net with respect to counterterrorism that is where it should be right at the moment. So the border security, port security, the technology to detect radiation or potential radioactive weapons, is none of these things are up to par yet. We still have very, very scary amounts of minimal screening of cargo that gets shipped on passenger airliners. With the vast majority of it's not screened at all, so we have no idea what people are putting in that cargo that's going on the planes that we're flying around on. So we have huge holes in our ability to detect and deal with terrorism. There's great evidence that terrorism is now dispersed and larger in terms of an international threat. And on top of that, we have the problem of our preparedness not being where it should be. So we have a tremendous amount of work to do in a country that is still quite vulnerable.
We have a couple calls to talk with. Let's go next to our Urbana listener, line number one. Good morning.
Hi, I'm listening to you. I'm sort of making some broad leaps and comparisons, and generalizations. I find it really interesting that Republicans often run on the platform that they're friendly to business and they know business, and it seems as though what the Bush administration has picked up is some of the worst qualities of some business practices, cronyism, and not paying attention to the professionals, rather than taking advantage of government expertise that has been developed. It's been squashed. And the other thing, is, in terms of what you're talking about with FEMA, for instance. And then the other thing is that it's not just with disaster preparedness and these grants with regard to Homeland Security with no accountability. It seems as though that's the general rule with regard to the
everything.
Yeah. And not only is there not accountability, but one of the programs that we have as a must-see, we try not to miss it, though we miss some, is now on public television on Friday nights at 7:30. And they've had interviews with people who were in charge of accountability, who were fired because they were trying to say, hey, there's no accountability. So we got rid of the people who watch out for that. And to me, that is less than lack of competence. That's total, it's obscenely, what's the right word for it?
Irresponsible.
Irresponsible. Yeah. And it there's no sense that we have that there's a good, that there are things that government needs to do, and it's not just fight wars, and it's not just make the rich richer.
We are
civilization depends on our working together on a whole variety of things and our putting up the money for it and putting our money where our mouths are and not just saying, let's just, anyway.
No, I obviously agree with you, and you're making some very good points here. It's really, it's reflective how we've handled preparedness and all the challenges since 9/11. Has been really reflective of some deep, deep changes in the way we like to think our country works. And to tell you the truth, I was actually pretty shocked at the level of incompetence after Katrina. And I've been involved in public health programs for more than 30 years now. I just couldn't believe it. I actually thought that when push came to shove, in a time of tremendous stress, that the government would get it together and function to, get people off the roofs and do what they had to do to really, to make great order and save lives. The fact that it was so fumbled, I was really quite taken aback. By the way, as was many of the, almost every country's newspapers, editorials were also shocked or dumbfounded about the lack of competence that Americans seem to exhibit in dealing with Katrina, and where it's going to take a long time to live down that reputation. But if you think about it, and I've totally been accused of going too far with this, but if you look at what's happening in Iraq, whether or not you agree with whether we should be in there in the first place, but the incompetence there in terms of goal setting, understanding what we need, what are the benchmarks, what are the guidelines, what are we trying to do, that kind of disorganization and incompetence of thinking has been exactly what's being reflected in the way we've approached counterterrorism and preparedness. So I really do have some serious concerns about the fundamental structure of how government is working right now. It's not very encouraging, which is why I try to conclude the book with some very specific ideas about what government needs to do, and by the way, what citizens need to do in terms of the preparedness piece. So there's work to do, but none of it is unfixable, which is the thing that gives me some hope about this, is that we do have the ability and capacity in the United States to do things better than they're being done right now. And I'm really hoping that we get on this sooner rather than later.
One of the things that one of the NOW programs had on was about preparedness at nuclear power plants.
I go into this in the book also, that among the things that has been sorely neglected is this oversight and regulation for the security and safety of a couple of our most dangerous industries. One is the chemical industry, and the second is the nuclear power industry. Both of those have been just getting a free ride in terms of the level of security and safety there. We've allowed those industries to, quote-unquote, self-regulate, which is a formula for absolute disaster here. And I'm very worried about that. And not only with this case of the chemical plants, are they in dangerous areas, they're not sufficiently guarded, and they become prime candidates either for terrorism or just simply industrial accidents that could cause an enormous amount of grief in the country. But the trains that transport dangerous chemicals are often just going on train lines that go right through the center or near the centers of major urban areas. So there's a lot of work that we have to do in that arena as well, and I think it's everyone is pretty familiar with the fact that evacuation plans and safety plans around nuclear power plants are so inadequate that it's absolutely stunning.
Hope the caller will forgive me. We have a couple of people waiting in just about 10 minutes left. Our guest, Erwin Redlener, he's the author of the book, Americans at Risk, Why We Are Not Prepared for Mega Disasters and What We Can Do Now. He's also director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. And we'll go next to someone in Champaign County, line number two. Good morning.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I guess this is going to sound like a pile-on about the politics of the Bush administration, but, well, I think it's warranted. It seems to me that if you look at what went on before in New Orleans and Katrina, that something that hasn't been pointed out is that there was a privatized plan by this group called Innovative Emergency Management, and it was just apparently another example of cronyism. They didn't really produce anything. I don't know how many million dollars they got, but they got a couple at least. And according to the investigative journalist Greg Palast, the only qualifications the woman that ran this place had was she gave a lot to Republican. I don't know if you're familiar with a particular instance, but it seems to be replicated almost everywhere. I mean, if you look at Homeland Security, which I object to the title, but just the idea of putting a cabinet-level position, the Republicans oppose it, and they even politicized that. They put a poison pill in and made it a way of breaking union. So,
yeah.
I mean, they're not they don't believe that government can do anything, and consequently, government doesn't do anything except when it comes to, you know, dumping money into defense contractors and starting another war, apparently. So, there's only a few minutes, and I guess there are other people waiting, so I guess
I... No, I appreciate your comments.
Okay.
Right on. Yeah.
Thanks for the call. Well, we do have another caller waiting. We'll go next to them. Champaign listener, line number three. Good morning.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to just make a quick political comment in that I don't see any real difference between this administration and any other. Quite frankly, they all fall short, and they all are cronyist. I find the fact that everybody feels the need to pile on to Bush kind of disturbing, in that I don't see any real difference between Bush and, say, Carter.
Yeah.
They're all the same.
Well, I think, as I said earlier, I think there's always cronyism. You're completely correct about that. And it's a question of where do you, you know, let's say we recognize that every government, every president will appoint supporters to government positions. This is, you know, the spoils of war here. So
right.
We accept that. But what I'm saying is that during the Reagan administration, during the Clinton administration, during the Carter administration, and even during a senior George Bush administration, the George Bush one, those appointments were certainly made by Republican and Democratic presidents. But those were much more obscure appointments where, you know, we didn't really care that a high-end donor for the Republicans or the Democrats gets appointed as, the deputy assistant secretary of the Department of Commerce. It's not going to affect us. What is new here, though, is appointing people to these critical positions. It's where, you know, it's like saying, I'm going to make the chief surgeon in the hospital a friend of mine who's a lawyer. You just,
right.
Bizarre and out of place that it really does break the mold of the cronyism that had been, you know, a normal part of political life, let's say.
Yeah, well, that aside, I wanted to get more of a personal outlook here as to my preparedness. Basically, to prepare for a natural disaster of whatever sort comes up, I've put back about a month's worth of food several weeks' worth of water and a means to cleanse water should I run out.
Yes.
A means to dispose of my biological waste.
Yeah.
A little portable toilet, which amounts to a 5-gallon bucket, and and you know, bags to put the stuff in.
Yeah.
And a means to deal with you know, looters and the like. You know, in that I've got some ammunition and the like, that kind of thing. Because, quite frankly, you can't depend on the government.
No, you know, there's, I spend, you know, the last two chapters in the book, one is about what government needs to do, but the second is about the absolute necessity for citizens understanding they have a major role in preparing themselves and their communities. I mean, really, the bigger the disaster, the more likely it is that the average citizen will actually be the real first responder. You're the first responder. Government will not be 5 minutes away after a 911 call to them if the disaster is large, because they're going to be preoccupied, they may be disabled themselves, et cetera, et cetera. So the need for citizen responsibility here is absolutely crucial here. So stockpiling and other things. I have a different take on this, by the way, which people will see in the book, which is that this is not just about stockpiling. It's getting yourself mentally ready to deal with a big emergency or disaster, no matter what it might be. And I think that people maybe appreciate that this, it does take more than shopping to get ready for disasters.
This is a good point to sort of end on. We have about maybe 3-4 minutes left. I had an opportunity to interview a whole bunch of people who responded as volunteers, as people providing relief, you know, all walks of life in response to Hurricane Katrina as a part of this Katrina summit that's coming up. I mentioned at the beginning of the hour.
Right.
And without exception, the people who sort of rolled up their sleeves, and so many people did this, expressed how wonderful it was to be part of this volunteer effort, that they felt, you know, totally motivated and inspired, and they felt so proud that they could make a difference. And it just seemed like the thread that ran through all these narratives and these stories that people told was they wanted to have some way to make a difference. And I think that is almost a universal human characteristic.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And that ends up being very inspiring. And by the way, in spite of the criticism that myself and others have lavished upon what happened after Katrina, the reality is that on the local level, on the ground, were so many heroes, you couldn't even count them, of people who did what they had to do, of first responders who were spectacularly brave and self-sacrificing, and individuals who just simply helped neighbors. I mean, it was really a very heartwarming story on that level. And I kept thinking that if the government had behaved as responsibly as many of these people in the local communities did, the whole situation would have been a hell of a lot better.
You write that getting this right in terms of responding to disasters, mega catastrophes, et cetera, getting this right will require really a 5-way partnership: government, citizens, first responders, non-governmental organizations, and the private sector.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, there isn't any amount of, the way I put this generally is that, let's say the government was absolutely perfect, did everything it was supposed to do, we still wouldn't be prepared if citizens weren't engaged, if the not-for-profit organizations weren't engaged, because government, in fact, functionally cannot do it all. On the other side of the coin, no matter what citizens do to get prepared, everybody can be ideally prepared with all the stockpiling and everything else. If government's not doing its part, again, the system doesn't work. When you get a really large-scale disaster, all hands on deck. And we saw corporations like Walmart rise to the occasion, a lot of the major national delivery services, many of the pharmaceutical chains, did what they had to do. That all helped. And the more we can make people understand that whatever sector they're in, whether it's as a private citizen or in private business or in a not-for-profit, all those things have to be working in tandem with effective government programs, and that's really what this amounts to. But don't look to the government to solve all of our problems. But we do expect a level of appropriate competence and responsibility.
The book is Americans at Risk: Why We Are Not Prepared for Mega Disasters and What We Can Do Now. The publisher is Knopf, And the author has been our guest, Erwin Redlener. He's director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. And Dr. Redlener, if you don't mind, I'm going to piggyback plugging your book with this conference, which we're involved in later this week, starting Wednesday evening at the Virginia Theater in Champaign, the kickoff, a three-day conference on Katrina after the storm, civic engagement through arts, humanities, and technology. WLL is involved in it, also the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, the Krannert Center, a variety of other partners. And if you'd like to know more about that conference, please go to www.katrinasummit.uiuc.edu.
So, Jack, if I could just mention, actually, this AmericansAtRisk.com, where if people want to get more information about the book, AmericansAtRisk.com will provide some more information about what we talk about in there. So
good. And when we put the archive on our website, we'll put that website as well up
Great.
There for people to look. And thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jack. Bye-bye.